6:14, now lights on the Crescent City Connection, spectacularly glittering purple and orange, I guess for Halloween. Highs of 86 today, 40% chance for showers, 60% tomorrow, 40% on Saturday, and 20% on Sunday, which is odd because the highs on Sunday are 80, but then they say a cold front arrives and the highs are 86. But I guess the humidity comes down and then we're in the lower 80s. Andy Smith joins us now, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. And I'm guessing we always talk about the weather differences. I'm guessing you guys are having a little bit different weather in New Hampshire?
A little bit different. Currently a balmy 46 going up to about 70 today. So it's a nice fall day. The leaves have turned nicely orange in a lot of places. So it's a pretty day.
Good for y'all.
Come on up.
Son of a gun. Yeah, I'd like to do that. So I guess after the vice presidential debate, a big swing in the election has changed completely, right? Presidential election?
Absolutely. The thing is just the same as it was before the debate.
Yeah, that's what I figured. You know, really,
yeah, but
go ahead.
I say, but the press had a good week or two telling us how important that debate is going to be and how it likely can change the election because they have to sell advertising.
Mm. You hate to take that approach to it, but in a way, it's kind of right. Who's voting already in different states?
A lot of different states have voting. I think North Carolina actually is going to be coming up pretty soon. That'll be interesting to see what happens given the flooding they had in western North Carolina. I think Oregon's already got its going. I think Ohio's are sent out. So there are a lot of states. I haven't kept up with the exact number of states that are voting already. But, you know, to me, it's kind of – I've never been a big fan of this – of the early voting. I understand it. If you're absentee and you're going to be out of the office. Mm-hmm. But how hard is it to go and vote?
Mm-hmm.
And how – why is it that the United States, among pretty much all Western countries, has this long, long, long period of voting and then another week or so after the election's over to figure out – which votes we count and don't count because of mail stamps and all that sort of mm-hmm. stuff, where France had their elections this summer and they had the results up that night. I don't know.
It seems like
I'm frustrated.
It seems like I would say somewhat recent development, or at least if you were to put this on a chart, it seems like the early voting, that's something that didn't happen 20 years ago, did it?
It started really a little bit more than 20 years ago when the state of Oregon, in order to boost turnout, said, well, let's make it easier for people to vote. They can vote by mail.
Mm-hmm.
Then everybody got mailed their ballots in Oregon, and everybody can vote by mail in Oregon. Really didn't do much to turnout. Maybe bumped it up a little bit, went down a little bit some years. But it did change this idea that there's an election day and a campaign kind of builds to the election day, and people are going to get additional information all the way up to election day. Now it kind of presumes that a whole lot of the electorate's got the minds made up way in advance, and the campaigns like it because they call it banking those votes, so they don't have to go after those people on election day and try to get them to show up. They can concentrate their efforts on just those people who didn't show up. So this is something that's more for the benefit of the political campaigns than the electorate, in my view.
Although inconvenient, is there any evidence that it changes the accuracy of the results? Might change the accuracy of polling, or it might change, I guess, maybe campaign strategy. But has there ever been any evidence of real chicanery going on here?
Not really. You know, there's always some bits of fraud in elections, but because there's so many people and so many opportunities, but just nothing that rises to the point where it makes a difference in the outcomes. I guess the only one that I've seen recently where they had to redo the elections was in North Carolina. I think it was their CD9 back in 2016. They had to go and redo the election over because both sides, frankly, were harvesting votes in nursing homes. But other than those kind of rare occasions like that, it doesn't make much difference in the election. I mean, we got several hundreds of millions of people voting, and the few votes that might be shifted because of election gimmicks are pretty small in comparison to the total number of votes.
How important is North Carolina in this election? And I'll get to why I'm asking in a second.
Yeah, it's becoming more and more important. It was a close race. Obama won it twice. It's been seen as a battleground state. We thought this year that it was looking like it was leaning pretty heavily to the Republicans until they had that little problem with the governor at the top. And it's drifting back towards the Democratic column. But it's one of many states that's up in the air.
The reason I ask is that, to me, from what I've seen, Helene is North Carolina's Katrina. And I'm just trying to figure where our heads were at after Katrina and how that would have affected voting in a presidential race. I don't think it was an election year. No, it was 2005, so it was not an election year. But that would have been the last thing on anybody's mind. And I don't know about people that are gone I don't know if there's going to be a diaspora like there was here after Katrina for a while or not. I don't know. We'll take a break and you can reflect on that when we come back. And I just think it's interesting that Helene, if it comes down to North Carolina and Helene could be the difference maker, that's something that nobody saw coming. While we thought this was going to be Trump-Biden for a long, long time, then it changed, then Helene comes in, and maybe that could change it even more. 620 more when we come back. Traffic now, WWL. 625, back with Andy Smith, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. So going back to what I was saying, you know, we thought for a long time that it was going to be Biden-Trump, Biden-Trump, Biden-Trump. Then all of a sudden, hey, it's not. It's Biden-Harris. Then all of a sudden, Hurricane Helene devastates North Carolina, which I think is equivalent to Katrina hitting us. And I'm just wondering how that could change not just things in North Carolina, but how that could change the whole presidential election. Thoughts?
Well, a couple things. First off, the mechanics of the election. I imagine they'll be able to take care of that. They've got enough time between now and the election to set up some temporary places to vote. It's going to obviously be harder for people to get to some of those places with road closures and so forth. But, you know, most polling places tend to be fairly small geographically. And then, you know, people are going to be busy cleaning up for a long time. There's going to be a lot of construction, a lot of that going on, and that's voting's probably not highest on their mind. But that said, voting doesn't generally take that long. It may be something that people can do as a break. If turnout is depressed in that area, I think that it likely will hurt Democrats. Asheville in particular, which got hit the hardest, I think, of the major cities out there, is pretty heavily a Democratic college town. And that could hurt Democrats across the state, the difference, I think, between there and in New Orleans is that western North Carolina is very, very rural outside of Asheville, very mountainous and hilly, and the people that live there are kind of used to dealing with things themselves. You get a bad snowstorms up there in the winter, how you get around in those mountains with snow. You do get floods, not like these, obviously, but you've had floods before. So I think the people there will be able to get around it and be able to do okay. The college kids, and they're the ones who might leave for a while.
So do you think in any way, given you got to balance a lot of things here, you got to balance what happens in North Carolina. And all I'm going to is the mindset of people I know here. And I don't know if it's, again, you're talking about an entire state as opposed to an area in Louisiana. It was just New Orleans. I don't know how much of North Carolina is devastated. But the mindset of how concerned are you about voting? Plus, you got to factor in the importance of North Carolina as well as other states. So I'm just wondering, does this matter at all or not, Helene, when it comes to turning the presidential election?
I don't know. I think the thing that happened, I think, politically with Katrina was the perception that the Bush administration just wasn't doing much about it. Mm-hmm. And that politically hurt the Bush administration, but as you mentioned, it wasn't during an election year. Here, right at the election, you know, the Biden administration is going through, and I think most administrations have learned from Katrina that the appearance of doing something is really important, and sending the troops into the mountains and so forth to help out is probably going to mitigate any potential blowback that there would be against the administration. I think it's too early to say. My sense is it's not going to make that much difference. You got to remember, it's a rural area. It's not like New Orleans where you got hit in a big urban area. This is a rural place where things will get cleaned up. It's just not going to have as much of that physical damage that you saw in New Orleans.
And from the political, I guess the perception part of it. There's nobody stranded. There's nobody in the Superdome. There's none of that kind of stuff right. going on, and people in the streets begging for water. And not that it's not bad. You understand what I'm saying?
Right, and it's just despite the devastation there and kind of the isolation, it's probably easier to get supplies in an area like that mm-hmm. than it is in the city of New Orleans, where you had just a lot of water that sat there with nowhere to go. The water's already down in North Carolina because those floods in mountains, floods come up quick and then they go down pretty quick as well. So I don't think there's going to be that long-term problem.
So if you had to say right now, the election is going to turn on what?
It's going to turn on turnout. Who can get their people to the polls? That's going to make the difference. And because it's not a matter of convincing people that their candidate's the best candidate, it's a matter of getting your people to show up.
You're telling me nobody's changing their mind? I'm just kidding.
Not much.
Thank you, Andy. Appreciate your time, as
good
always.
To talk to you.
Andy Smith, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. Mike Strain joins us as we come back. Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. Bunch of stuff to talk with him about, and we always learn something. Then after that, we'll talk to Pat Connick, state senator, about Louisiana's new laws on labeling foreign seafood. Are they being followed? A lot coming up. Stay with us right now. Time for WWL First News. For that, we'll go to Dave Cohen. 6:43, 17 before 7, Thursday morning. That's when we talked to Mike Strain, Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. We learn something every time we talk to Mike. How you doing, Dr. Strain?
Man, I am doing great. How are you doing, Tommy?
I am doing okay. Let's talk about the port strike and how that could affect things.
Well, if you look at the port strikes, about half of the volume of goods that are imported and exported from the United States go through the ports and in containers. And if you look, you know, here, you know, in the port of New Orleans, it's significant. We have about, it could have $12 to $20 million a day effect on our local economy. It's an average of 1,300 units per day, and that's a 20-foot container. Coffee, poultry that we export, consumer goods, imports and exports, about half of all monthly U.S. imports go through the East and the Gulf Coast, and about one-fifth of all jobs are directly or indirectly tied to international trade. So it's huge. We have 700 ILA members in the Port of New Orleans and the Port of Baton Rouge. And the things, when we've had issues with containers, if you remember back when COVID, such as spare parts, that was a big deal for us in agriculture. And we had spare part issues. For instance, at that time, we had difficulty getting the blades, the cutting blades, to go on for the machines to harvest our sugar cane. And now we're beginning sugar cane harvest. You know, such things as, you know, if you look at a lot of spare parts are made overseas for vehicles. At the time, it was chips that were necessary to go and replace those in trucks that controlled their environmental systems. And if the chip went out, the truck went down, and then the truck, you know, you didn't have that unit. And so it's going to hurt. We got to get ready for it. Hopefully they will resolve this, but this is a bad time. I mean, we're right now, you know, we're in at harvest and we're trying to ship everything. Now our elevators that load directly on ships, the majority of those grain elevators, those are still operational, but it's the containers, but it's also most of our poultry. It moves out in containers at the Port of New Orleans. And so this is not a good thing. And what happens is that right now, you know, offshore, you'll start having ships that are start backing up. So everything kind of grinds to a halt. And it's going to hurt us economically. But there are second and tertiary effects that we're going to begin to feel.
Is this big enough, Mike, or could this get serious enough? And I don't mean to say something I shouldn't say here, but because it might not be accurate, but where a president would invoke Taft-Hartley or anything like that and force him back to work?
Well, they're talking about it. Right now, the president is urging the port officials basically to say, look, go ahead and y'all need to get on the stick and come to some agreement. But yes, absolutely, to say, look, y'all have to go ahead and go back to work. And we're going to negotiate, and they can do that. You know, that's like the 2 or 3 weeks at a time, and you get some solid negotiations. And because you can't just allow them to shut down. If you remember during the Reagan years, when all the air traffic controllers said we're going to walk out, we'll say, well, but you can't under your contracts. where we're going. Remember what Reagan did? He just fired them all. Yep. What he did, and they started all over again. And that, because the skies were snarled here, you know, under the Taft-Hartley Act, they need to come to the negotiating table and need to keep working, because again, it's about the health of the nation. And right now, let me tell you something: things are tight out there economically. And when you start looking at all the different factors of our economy, the manufacturing factor sectors, the ag sectors, you know, just the average household, mom and pop, we don't need this right now. And here we are going into the holiday season, the Christmas season, and of course all the what we call it Walmart stuff is on those containers, as well as very vital components, because we're worldwide integrated now. And so, you know, you'll have those, well, look, let's just buy American. Well, you've got to have the ability to manufacture that and get it into the system. But it shows you our interdependence in worldwide economics.
Speak to, Mike, people panic buying stuff, because, you know, people sometimes cause their own problems, right? So talk about that,
well,
if you
that,
will, please.
Yeah, panic buying. And, for instance, I was told yesterday that if you go to Costco or Sam's, you're not going to find any toilet paper. It's gone, right? People are buying things by the cases, yeah. You know, and so please don't panic buy, because that exacerbates the whole problem. And look, you don't need to be going panic buying bread or milk or ground beef, because that's not going to be really affected here. That's going to be there. But everybody, just buy what you need. But the panic buying, again, further skews our delivery system. Our whole delivery system for goods is based on just the minimum amount needed to make it for the shortest time possible. So it's very streamlined. And when it happens, you throw a monkey wrench into that, and it really shuts the gears down, literally. So you have to have that mental picture. So please don't panic buy, because that will really make the whole system worse, and it will cause a great deal of issues. But then it goes back to show you that interdependence. You know, one time we had a huge facility. Georgia Pacific had a facility on the north side of Baton Rouge. They still make Brawny towels, but they used to make toilet paper and other products, and now they make Brawny towels. And so, again, it shows our interdependence with international trade.
And they make toilet paper in the United States, right, before people get freaked out?
Yes, they make toilet paper in the United States. We need to look at, you know, ways that we can make our manufacturing more efficient so that we can be more competitive than the foreign players, because the foreign players have to make it, then they have to ship it, and it's got to be handled multiple more times. And so we really need, I mean, we have a massive amount of pulp here, a massive amount to make these products. We need to utilize that versus shipping pulp. And one of the things we were talking with my counterparts in Georgia and South Carolina after the hurricane, you know, the hurricane damaged all that timber. They normally ship timber out by containers, you know, going overseas, and now they got all this down timber, no way to ship it out. And so that's another issue that, you know, when you start looking at the greater and more long-term effects, and the thing about the timber that's down is due to the hurricane, you have a very short window, less than 6 weeks, to get it out, because the timber starts, it gets like a mold or a fungus on it, and then it has no value at all.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. Mike Strain. We'll talk about some fun stuff when we come back. Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. Got any questions or comments? 260-504-260-1870. That's the Oakland Art Jeweler talk and text line. I'll pass them along. 651 9 till 7. Traffic now, WWL. 6:55, 5 till 7. Thursday morning means we're talking to Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry Commissioner Dr. Mike Strain. Mike, it's Fire Prevention Week, and man, it's a time of year where people are supposed to check, what, the smoke detectors, and then before you know it, it'll be cold, and people start using space heaters, so we may as well talk about all that.
Absolutely. And Fire Prevention Week, you know, it's really, really important, and now is the time. Change out the batteries in those smoke alarms and test them, you know, and if those smoke alarms are old, say 10 years or so old, you may consider go ahead and replacing them. So the newer smoke alarms have 10-year batteries, and they're basically, you know, like a LED light in it and a 10-year battery, and replace them. And really, you need to strategically place them. They need to be in every bedroom, outside each separate sleeping area in the hallway and also on every floor. Smoke alarms, CO2 alarms, they save your life. They really do. Because as you hear, you know, a lot of times when people die in a fire, it's because they never woke up with smoke inhalation. Also, you know, again, when you talk about generators and generator safety, that generator needs to be at least 3 feet away from your house or four, where the exhaust can get out. And with fire safety, as we get into headed towards holiday season, you know, you don't fry that turkey next to the house or under the porch. Because inevitably, what's going to happen? Flame over or flash over. And we need to start thinking about that. And, of course, you know, with space heaters, the biggest rule of space heater, you know, put it properly in a good place, but don't put any rugs over the cords. That's a big deal, especially extension cords. That is a big cause of fires. You know, and when cool weather comes, you have those space heaters, and the rugs over the electric cords, the extension cords, causes them to overheat and causes fire. So now is the time. And if you have any questions, you can always visit your local fire department. They are more than glad to help. A lot of the fire departments are having activities here in Abita Springs, Fire District 8. They had a huge activity for families and kids, and a lot of times, you know, they'll be giving away smoke detectors and other things. So now's the time. Check around the house. Check those smoke detectors. And look, it's better to put a new battery in now than 3 o'clock in the morning to hear that thing chirping and you don't have a battery. You know,
right.
There's nothing.
You're right.
Oh, my gosh. And you can't figure out which one it is. And if you have a smoke alarm that is hardwired, that battery goes out. It will not shut up until you put a new battery in it.
Mm-hmm. Mike, let's talk about, there's nothing I like more than driving around on a country road in a fall in Louisiana and seeing a sugarcane trucks. I don't know why, but
man, they're rolling.
Yeah, go ahead. Talk about that.
Yeah, the sugarcane harvest is underway. You know, we got most of the plant cane in the ground because you cut that first cane and then you replant it. But we'll be firing up the mills, and we have just a small amount is harvested, and it's really rolling. We're about 6% harvested. And it's looking good. We're very fortunate. We've had some good weather, and that cane has recovered a lot from the hurricanes. And so it's beautiful. But give them a little extra room. Think about that. We got about $1.2 billion worth of cane to harvest, and hopefully we will be done now by early January. We used to have it done by December, but we got so much cane, it goes on a little bit longer. Give them a little extra time. Give them a little extra space. And, you know, we see those tractors and those harvesters, because they are rolling. And when the thing about sugarcane, every farmer has a quota they have to meet every day.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate your time and information. As always, Mike Strang, Commissioner, Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. I was in Raceland coming home one Saturday evening. The sun was going down. The LSU game was on WWL. The weather had just turned cold. The sugarcane trucks were on the road, and you could smell it, and it was just fall in Louisiana, man. I'm looking forward to that. We'll come back, talk to Pat Connick, state senator, about Louisiana seafood labeling. Chance for rain today and tomorrow, then it clears out and cools off a little bit. Highs in the lower 80s, and the humidity is going to be down, so it should feel a little bit nicer. Pat Connick joins us now, Louisiana state senator, to talk about Louisiana's new laws on labeling foreign seafood. How you doing, Senator?
Doing great, Tommy. Good morning.
I saw this story in the Illuminator about some testing that happened at the Louisiana Shrimp and Petroleum Festival in Morgan City. 4 out of 5 vendors evaluated serving foreign shrimp passed off as local. I know there's a big concern of yours. I know we've had some legislation that's passed to kind of prevent this kind of thing. Tell me what's going on here.
It's shocking, but it's not shocking. Like I said in the article, Wes Muller with the Louisiana Illuminated wrote a great story. You know, the shrimp is hurting in Louisiana. The shrimp industry is dying, basically. These guys go out, spend a lot of money, catch shrimp, 10, 16 pound per pound shrimp. They get 90 cents at the dock, and they can't afford it. And the reason why that's taking place is because the cheap imports have flooded the market. All the warehouse space that we have in the state is full of imported shrimp. And there's no room for our domestic product. And when that happens, the price drops. And but when you look at the product that's coming in from India and all these other countries, they're being repackaged and relabeled as a Louisiana-type product. And it's deceptive. And That's what's happening, and that's what we're trying to stop, you know.
I don't understand how that can happen. Is it just flagrantly flaunting the law?
You know, the shrimp comes in from foreign countries, and the FDA only tests a small percentage of the shrimp imports, you know. I think there's a 2020 study by LSU that found two-thirds of the shrimp imports tested were contaminated. Yet this is coming in, and dealers are repackaging as, you know, Cajun land or Le Bon Temps Roulet. But when you look at the label, you know, it has a Louisiana symbol on it. Mm-hmm. But when you turn it over, it says, you know, product of China, a product of Vietnam, product of Ecuador or India. You know, by law, we cannot stop imported seafood, but we can stop imported seafood from being sold as seafood coming from the Gulf of Mexico and Louisiana. And that's the law that was passed. It goes into effect on January 1st, 2025, and there's some penalties that go with that.
Whose purview is it I don't understand how you can send shrimp over from India and they remain fresh or they remain whatever it is. They got to treat them with something. I don't understand how they can do that and how they can even compete with shrimp that come right out of the Gulf. I guess that's what confuses me.
It's an inferior product. The problem with the shrimp that's from overseas, that's farm raised, it's contaminated. They use antibiotics so the shrimp don't die. And they freeze them, and they come across and defrosted, and they put in the containers that you see in the stores, and people buy them. They think they buy Louisiana shrimp, and it's not. I mean, I represent shrimpers in Lafitte and Grand Isle. Dean Blanchard is a good friend of mine. He has a shrimp dock in Grand Isle, and he's about to close down. It's just because they cannot compete with the stuff coming in from overseas. But the sad part about this and the thing that's so wrong is that the stuff's coming overseas are being packaged with our labels that from the culture of Louisiana, mm-hmm. the Gulf of Mexico, and that's the deception that we have we put laws in to stop, and it's going to be some penalties that's going to be coming forward. Like if an importer mislabels a package, they can be fined $15,000 to $50,000 a pop. Restaurants that say they have they serve in the U.S. you know, caught seafood and they serve in foreign shrimp can be fined $200 to $500 per violation. Before it was a slap on the wrist, but you know, there's some penalties that go along with this new law. Hopefully we can, you know, we can't stop the foreign imports from coming in and we can't stop people from buying foreign imports, but we can make sure when people are buying the shrimp they know where they come from. And that's what we're trying to do here.
We can't, as a state, say, you know what, you can't sell shrimp from India in this state. You can't sell shrimp from wherever in this state. You can't do that?
It's federal law. It's the Commerce Clause. I think there was a law. There were some laws passed in Louisiana early on in 2020, you know, maybe 20 years ago. There was a federal lawsuit, and the state lost. But I used that lawsuit, I used the ruling from that court to draft language in this law to make sure that it would pass, you know, any scrutiny. If someone sues over the new law we passed, we will win based on the way it's written.
When it comes to restaurants, do you find that there's the primary problem is locally owned restaurants or chain restaurants or what?
It goes across the board, Tommy. You know, we want to work with the Restaurant Association, and we did work with the Restaurant Association with this legislation. They had a major role in drafting it. They know that this is a problem, you know, and they know that they can't deceive the public. You saw what happened in Biloxi with Mary Mahoney's restaurant. Mm-hmm. They were selling red snapper as coming from the Gulf when it was foreign. And that's a violation of a federal law with what they were doing. And I think some folks are going to jail over there. But the whole purpose is for the public to understand what are they buying. Is it an import or is it a domestic caught Louisiana shrimp? Don't bring in an import that's inferior and contaminated and pass it off as a Louisiana product. And that's wrong. You know, put all the Chinese labeling on it and see how much you sell for that. They can't do that. So they use our culture and our heritage and to make a profit, you know, on the backs of our shrimpers.
I want to pick it up here when we come back because, you know, when, in every market you got supply and you got demand, right? So if we would eliminate the demand or if we could educate people enough to eliminate the demand, well, then maybe, you know, that would stop the supply part of it. We'll talk more when we come back. I also want to talk about the governor's proposed tax plan, and I think it might be a little bit of a, you know, what is it, post-hoc, ergo, propter hoc, to say that the only reason Louisiana's losing population is because of the tax base, a tax structure. I think that's a stretch, but we'll talk more about it when we come back. Senator Pat Connick, our guest, Louisiana State Senator, talking about mislabeling of seafood and I wouldn't eat that stuff from India. I really don't. And we will talk more about checking the packages and what you need to look for, because you do have to look closely. Pat talked about the appropriation of culture, and it is. They make that package look like it's from Louisiana, but it is not. 720, traffic now, WWL. 725 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with State Senator Pat Connick talking about Louisiana and what seafood and testing at the Louisiana Shrimp and Petroleum Festival that showed 4 out of 5 vendors were serving foreign shrimp passed off as local. Pat, I was talking about, you know, educating people. I don't want to eat any of that stuff. If I wouldn't use sheetrock from another country or you know the problems that we've had with that, why would you eat anything from there? With that being said, if we could just cut down the demand on this where people wouldn't buy it and it would go unsold and then they'd have to get rid of it, maybe stores would stop carrying it. Some of the ways to make sure that you buy in Louisiana seafood?
It's just, you know, people need to know what they're buying, and right now you don't know. I mean, it's insane that at the Louisiana Shrimp and Petroleum Festival, they're selling, you know, shrimp from India, you know, and then how can the locals compete with that? The whole purpose of the legislation that we passed is to educate, make sure that the people who are selling identify where the shrimp are coming from. If it's local, you know, put it up there. And if it's foreign, make sure we know about it. The law requires a certain font in a certain type setting, and that goes into effect in January 1st, 2025. I think the retailers wanted that delayed implementation of the law to allow board that had it in stock to go out. But, you know, Louisiana is full of foreign shrimp, and it's hurting our shrimpers.
Is there any way to for the state to put a tariff on foreign seafood? No, huh?
This is all federal law. I think there's some bills in Washington, D.C. to try to do something to raise the tariffs, but none of that has taken place. You know, these stores who sell this stuff, and it's a cheap product, and they make a higher margin on it. The restaurants want, you know, they buy low and then sell high. But, you know, if they cannot deceive the public of, I can't tell you, Tommy, I'm serving you a shrimp caught from the Gulf of Mexico at my restaurant, and when it's from India. But people are doing that now. And you know, that's what the law is trying to design to stop and fix it.
Let's talk real quick about the governor's tax plan and what is special session, all that stuff. You've had a chance to look any of it over, Pat?
Listen, I got in the mail 2 days ago a book about 3 inches long, 3 inches wide,
yeah,
that I have not had the chance to go through. I know some of the stuff that's in it. They want to eliminate a bunch of the tax credits.
Right.
That's on the table. Consolidate a bunch of accounts. You know, put a flat tax in that's going to go like 3% across the board and give credits to some folks who are low income. I think something has to give. We need to do something. I'm willing to listen, and I'm willing to make some tough votes to make the change needed in the state to be more competitive. Right now, our system is really, you know, convoluted the way we do things here. So hopefully we can eliminate some of that and move forward. And I'm excited about it, Tommy. I don't want to go back to Baton Rouge in November for a special session, but I will.
Yeah.
And I'm ready to make some tough votes.
Thank you. Appreciate your time, Senator. Senator Pat Connick, fellow Shaw graduate. We'll take a break. We come back, we're going to talk to Adam Knapp, CEO of the Committee for 100, to continue conversation about Governor Landry calling for a special session on tax reform and to address looming fiscal cliff. We'll see what the Committee of 100 for Economic Development would like to see lawmakers like State Senator Pat Connick do. Then we'll talk to Representative Mandy Landry, a Democrat, to check in with her to see how she's feeling about the special session on tax reform. So a lot coming up. Stay with us right now. Time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Dave Cohen. All right, 7:45, 16 till 7. Quickly to Adam Knapp, CEO of the Committee for 100. How you doing, Adam?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you back. I got an executive summary here, 10 pages from the Committee of 100, Louisiana Fiscal Reform Framework for the Future. Pat Connick just now on with us, Senator Connick, saying he got it, a binder with the governor's plan, 3 inches thick. He's going through that. This is complicated stuff. First of all, is the Committee of 100, the executive summary that I got, is that in lockstep with the governor's plan, or are those suggestions that the governor is going to borrow from? Take me through that.
Yeah, so we actually did that project 10 years ago. That was a 2015
really?
Study that we did.
So
we hired a group called the Tax Foundation that the governor has been quoting quite a bit to tell us, hey, if Louisiana wanted to make an ideal tax structure competitive for business investment, what would that look like? And this nonprofit group, the Tax Foundation, that really studies state tax structures, wrote this, what is a lengthy report of what to do with income tax, franchise tax, you name it. And really what's interesting and why it's great that you have that is we looked at this a decade ago, and a lot of what was said in the Tax Foundation's report back then, independent of us, is what we see a lot of the ideas coming forward from the administration. Getting rid of a lot of credits and exemptions that are loopholes in the tax structure to try to use that to lower the overall rates. As you said, it's really complicated, but at the heart of it, that's what the governor's trying to think through and Secretary Nelson is trying to think through.
And the top line mentions the 2015. In my own mind's eye, I don't think of that as almost a decade ago, but it is, and that's just how time flies. Adam, how can you, explain in the best way, maybe some of the highlights or some of the best or the things you would like to see the legislature. Well, first off, tell me about the Committee for 100 for people that don't know what that is, because it sounds like a group that would round up people and put them in a re-education camp, and it's not.
It does strike one as sort of vaguely odd and secretive, right?
Yeah.
No, what it is, it's a group of nonpartisan executives from companies around the state, individuals who want to have an impact on the future of Louisiana, especially related to economic development. We've been at this for about 30 years in different ways to try to use senior executive leadership to really try to drive change for Louisiana and improve things. And there are members all over Louisiana, from New Orleans to Shreveport and parts in between, who have an interest in the future of the state. So what we did, this actual report was done, commissioned by our membership, whatever that is, 9 years ago, to try to really dig into the complex issues of tax reform. It's been talked about a million times, studied it ad nauseum. We thought, let's just try to get it all in one place. What I think is relevant today is this is not new stuff that the administration is trying to dig into. And while it feels like it may be afresh because they're bringing it forward and we're just starting to get some of the details of what they want to do, they've been working on this based on a lot of the input that's come forward over the last really almost two decades, but especially since our report was done. It just gets really complicated, as you said, when you try to write it into law, that you get this, you know, 3-inch thick binder that's being shared of all the bills that try to make these changes happen.
You say back 9 years ago, a lot of things, technically, technology, the economy has changed, I think, in the last 9 years. Is that report still, I know you said it was no new, I guess, old stuff that's been around for a long time, however you phrased it. I don't mean to denigrate the report at all.
No, that's right. So the biggest things that have changed, Tommy, is that what the services are that have come into the marketplace that are sometimes not part of what's being taxed. For example, they're talking about how do you expand some of the sales tax that we pay to some of the goods that are newer, digital goods, software as a service that now wasn't really as prominent 10 years ago, things like we use Netflix streaming services. those are all part of how we used to get movies at a paid sales tax on a DVD rental, but they don't do that on the same movie streams. So what they're trying to use is all these changes to help reduce the overall income tax rates. And I think that's admirable. It makes us more competitive. The devil's in the details, though. And we really want to make sure that we have a role as our organization to review the details and try to advise them on whether both the numbers look right that they're using, but also that they get the tax policy right from a competitiveness standpoint. And a lot of companies have a lot of complicated different things that get hit by different taxes or tax breaks, and so we want to understand what those look like.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking about the governor's plan for a special session and what tax reform could look like. Adam Knapp is our guest, CEO of the Committee for 100. If you have any questions, comments, 504-260-1870. That's the Oakland Art Jeweler Talk and Text Line. More when we come back. Time now for traffic on WWL. 7:54, 6 till 7, Tommy Tucker, 6 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Adam Knapp, CEO of the Committee for 100, talking about a plan to reform the state's tax code. I see a tweet from Jan Mulder of the Louisiana Budget Project saying that these are things that are going to be taxed, and I'm just going to read some of them. And you mentioned Netflix before. Short-term rentals, ticket sales, including fees, printing, copying, and I'm just picking here, car washes, interior design, decorating, personal marina services, personal fitness training, quilting, tanning. I don't know. The only reason I bring it up, wrecking and towing, is for those that would say, Adam, that this is not really revamping the code, but just shifting taxes or shifting the tax burden. What would you say to that?
Well, the governor said exactly that in his description of what his goals are and aims are in the tax reform structure. His goal is to reduce the income tax, which we've seen this be done in states like North Carolina, where they've shifted their tax structure to try to reduce their overall personal income tax rate and their corporate tax rate, as the governor described it, to try to put less of the tax structure on the work that we do in our work in the economy, and put more of it on our choices as we make purchases, and those are what you see in those sales taxes. What's interesting is that list of things that are kind of personal sales taxes that the governor would add are similar to ones that are taxed in Texas or in North Carolina or other states. They've kind of gone through this at the Department of Revenue to try to figure out what are things that are taxed in other sales taxes that aren't included in ours. But in it, they're also going to eliminate things like prescription drugs across the board for local and state taxes, as part of these trade-offs. So what's interesting to me, and I think is an important thing for listeners to we should all be doing, is seeing how it affects us across the entire spectrum of changes. So as you read something that might be added, look for what also might be removed or changed or lowered and see how that balance affects you. We've heard from Secretary Nelson at the Department of Revenue, who ran for governor, was a state rep from the North Shore, that they're going to put some sort of calculator that any individual can go and put in, you know, who they are, what they do, or not who they are, but some information about themselves. And it'll help, you know, give you a way to determine how it's going to affect each person.
A dashboard kind of like, is that up already or not?
I don't think so. I think he said they're working on getting that up, and it should be up pretty soon. This is all planned to be deliberated in November, sometime between kind of the national election and when we all, you know, break for Thanksgiving. So this is going to be about the month of October is our month of let's get our hands, sleeves rolled up and our hands dirty, kind of understanding what the proposal is. And they're going to be talking about this really actively in the legislature in November.
States that don't have an income tax do have higher property taxes. Is that something that the Committee of 100 looked at or not?
We did not, and that is not part of what's being proposed today. The administration is not really sales tax or property taxes in Louisiana all go to local governments, not to the state. And so it really isn't part of a state tax reform structure.
So for people that are worried about their homestead exemption, that's a local concern, not a statewide concern?
It's in the Constitution, but that is untouched, is unchanged, and the administration made clear they're not doing anything to change the homestead exemption.
All right, let me ask you quickly about tax credits and jobs and so forth. I think I was one of the first ones years ago to ask about film industry credits. Took a lot of heat for it because I was just wondering, on the back end, we're giving all these credits, but if you're not really making any money off of it, then you're kind of subsidizing the jobs, and you may as well be working for the state after you do it all, you know, at the bottom line. You know what I'm saying here, Adam?
It's a big and expensive program. Now, I think you're...
And I'm not just talking about film. I'm talking about in general tax credits.
Any of those.
Yeah.
That's right. And they are... They're designed, and this is all across the country. They're designed to try to induce certain economic activity. In that case, they're trying to, you know, grow a film industry and the creative industry in the state that's been, you know, very active since that was created back in the early 2000s. Heavily influencing the economy in New Orleans, some in Baton Rouge and Shreveport, and other films around the state. It's going to be interesting to see how that debate rolls out. The administration's point, it's worth debate, is these create special arrangements for certain industries to try to grow in the state, but don't benefit every business in the state or every individual in the state. If we could lower the overall rates by getting rid of some of these, would that be better for everybody?
I think
that's the debate that's about to happen.
Yeah, I think you have to look at it as from the taxpayers, from the, you know, the Treasury, is it a net gain or loss? And go from there. Thank you, Adam. I appreciate your time. I know you come back and talk to us again about this. Adam Knapp, CEO of the Committee for 100. When we come back, we're going to talk to Mandy Landry, Louisiana State Representative, to get her take on this. She's a Democrat. And then we'll talk to Bryson Graham, General Manager of the Pelicans. You talk about a story. We're excited about carrying the games as well. All righty, it is 8:15, and we're joined by our friend Mandy Landry, Louisiana State Representative, a Democrat from New Orleans. How you doing, Mandy?
Good morning, Tommy.
I'll go ahead and say a graduate of Notre Dame and Georgetown Law.
Yes, sir.
All right. Let's talk about the governor's call for a special session, or he's not yet made a call, right?
Right. He hasn't. We expect it to occur, the session. It'll probably start a couple of days after the presidential election and hopefully end by Thanksgiving. He has a couple of weeks to actually officially call us in.
So have you gotten a binder, you know, like Pat Connick told me, 3 inches thick with the plan or what?
Oh, I did. I don't think I've ever read something on so much paper since I've been there. Usually
yeah.
It's just electronic.
Well, let's talk about that, because everything that you change, every action has a reaction, right? So when you talk about something that's 3 inches thick and changing the tax policy for the entire state, boy, that's going to be hard to get through and understand the ramifications of everything on this by November, is it not?
Well, I mean, you hit like the larger point of all this is this is one of the biggest things we're going to do. You know, healthcare, education, transportation is all policy, but this is our entire budget to run the entire state. And to rush this through in a short amount of time with relatively new people, and guess what? None of us are tax experts. Mm-hmm. So we need a little time to look at this. And I feel like we're playing like tax whack-a-mole when they talk about, well, we're going to take off the income tax and then we're going to add tax on tanning beds. I mean, that's not a joke. That's some of the stuff that's in there.
I know. I was talking about it earlier with Adam Knapp, and I think his point was that it was more to, I guess, push it toward a consumption tax than an income tax, maybe? Or I don't quite know what they're trying to do.
So, you know, the governor talked about in his press conference that they were trying, at least in part, to make it more of a tax on services versus, you know, products. Like, he kept talking about dog grooming and streaming services like Netflix, which those are things like you can, you know, you choose to do. You may not have a dog, but that's, to me, those are pennies compared to what we you know, what we collect from everything else. I mean, there's some funny things on this, Tommy. Like, one of them is to impose taxes on quilting, embroidery, and monogramming services.
Yeah, I did mention quilting. Photo finishing.
There's, like, big quilting out there.
Private process servers, spas and massages, and storage space units, tanning. I just wonder if...
Grass cutting.
Yeah, if somebody's... run the numbers on this. I imagine they have. I don't know. Do you know?
I don't know. Nope. You would think I would know. I'm one of 105. But that was one of my first questions. I'm like, how much is this going to generate compared to the billions lost through all the other items? Also, as you know, politically, we'll get up there on the floor and, you know, Senator Connick might have 5 tanning bed stores in his district, and I might have 3 quilters, and all of a sudden everyone's trying to remove, you know, the people who are calling them worried about their business.
What are you hearing from your fellow legislators about this? The caucus, I guess you guys have some kind of, you belong to some kind of caucus?
The House Democratic Caucus, I'm a member. There are several others. We just got this. I picked mine up Thursday, yesterday morning, Wednesday. Some people received theirs Tuesday. So no one really knows what's in it besides what you and I just talked about, because we don't have an electronic copy. I guess there's a reason for that, but it's getting out there. Obviously, as Democrats, were worried about any increase on any sort of sales tax, as that affects people who make the least amount of money the worst. We're worried about just completely destroying the state's budget. Worried about repeating what Jindal did when he kind of destroyed the state's budget, and in general, just worried about the speed.
Did all of this start when the Steli plan was eliminated?
I know what you're talking about, but that was before my time. Mm-hmm. I generally know. But from what I remember you mentioning is that we had a decent plan back then, the Steli plan. And then some people came in and sort of raided it. Is that kind of what you remember it?
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. And it seems like it's been a struggle since. And I'm just wondering, let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. 8:20, we're talking to Mandy Landry, Louisiana State Representative, getting the Democrat side of the governor's plan to call a special session and change the tax structure in Louisiana. And I know I heard somebody earlier say that it was the reason for Louisiana losing population. I think there are a lot of reasons for Louisiana losing population. We'll get Mandy's take on this as well, besides just the way we tax different businesses and different organizations. We'll also talk about tax credits for industries, etc. When we come back, traffic now, WWL. 8:24, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Back with Mandy Landry, representative from New Orleans, a Democrat, talking about the governor's plan to change a tax structure. Somebody texted in and said in their small circle, and I don't know that this is inaccurate. I know the majority that have left the state is because of auto and property insurance, not taxes. Do you think really that's the major driver of people leaving the state, outpopulation, is taxes?
No, not at all. I mean, we've been hearing that for years, and even a lot of our Republican friends say that's crazy. I mean, right now it's homeowners insurance and inability to afford your home. I'm feeling that. Orleans Parish has high taxes. Others don't. Property taxes as much. School system is troubling. We don't have doctors in rural areas. It's just kind of the same stuff brought out every time. And look, like, the tax code here is very complex and confusing. We all agree on that. And everyone thinks they pay too much in taxes and that nobody else pays enough. That's a policy decision. But really, it's the speed of what's going on here that makes me really concerned, very concerned.
So when it comes to the film industry and other industries that get tax credits, I don't know how you determine what's in the best interest of the state or the public, because you would have at some point have to see a bottom line or a ledger that shows, well, we gave this many credits, but it provided this, right?
So they have that to an extent, sort of, and that's one of the reasons that some people who don't like the film industry, they'd say it's just sending money to people in California, which is absurd. But a lot of times they're not looking at things like the film industry. They go to Lowe's, they go to Home Depot, all the payroll taxes they pay, they go antiquing in every area, they, you know, feed all the people. There's a diversity of jobs. There's just a lot of things going on in some of these industries that they don't pay attention to. And for things like the film industry, they cut that tax, they're putting people out of work. And I just don't know if we're going to be able to convince people in other parts of the state what's important to us down here. And I don't know if we're going to be able to convince them to slow down, but you know who might be able to do it is our neighbor, Cameron Henry, president of the Senate. He's the one who's kind of been holding the line on this. So
how do you see this playing out?
I think it's 50-50 we have it, but I would bet against having it because it's too fast and doing it next year. are doing a lot of this during our fiscal session. Apparently, they want to push a lot of it now and put some of this on our ballot in the spring. So that would mean you, me, everyone going to vote in March or April when we normally wouldn't, to decide if we want to agree to change our Constitution to do all of the tax things and more. By the way, one of the bills being proposed is to cut taxes on oil and gas further. I'm serious. That's fine. Anyway, we would go.
Well, wait, no, for you, for people that don't understand why you said I'm serious, explain that.
I mean, taxes are already low. The industry has gotten everything they've ever wanted for a couple generations, if not longer. To put that in there, that they should pay less taxes, is just kind of unbelievable, especially considering we have all lawsuits that show that a lot of companies over decades and decades, they didn't put land back like they were supposed to, which led to coastal erosion. I mean, this isn't, you know, exactly apples and oranges, but it's all in the same. I can't believe I'm saying this. It's all in the same fruit basket. So there's cuts there. There's cuts to corporate taxes. There's a lot in there that people are not going to like when they start to see the details.
So
that's my opinion.
So how do you get, what's your next step here, Representative? What do you try to pour through this? You talk to experts in the industry. What do you do?
Yeah. So next week, so I'm going to try to read some more. I read some last night in preparation. Next Tuesday and Wednesday, for anyone who wants to watch the House of Representatives, the Ways and Means Committee, which is the tax committee, is meeting on Tuesday and Wednesday, starting at 10 Tuesday, and you can watch it live. And so we're going to be taking testimony from the Department of Revenue and I don't have it in front of me, but from several different agencies and individuals, and anyone can come talk about it. And then from there, I think the committees and the caucuses are going to be having meetings weekly or twice weekly.
The reason I brought up Notre Dame and Georgetown Law, and I mean it sincerely, is, and I'm not trying to curry favor with you, you are a very intelligent person, and I'm just wondering, for you to get through the all the different ramifications of this radical change of the state's tax structure and who it could affect, what's good, what's bad, that's complicated stuff. And do you think you got a hearing next week? I guess that's where you start listening and seeing and determining who's telling what right and wrong.
I it's going to be a slog. It really is going to be difficult for most of us. And so far I haven't seen that there is any expert on taxes or an economist involved, but hopefully I'll be told different next week.
Cause this is very complex stuff. This is not simple stuff, to be clear, right?
No, I mean, we could lose billions. I mean, it's billions of dollars we're talking about moving around. And they have this trickle down. A lot of people have a trickle down sense. Oh, we'll just cut Mandy's taxes. She'll go spend it elsewhere. Or I might put it in my savings. Or I might just put it to my homeowners that I'm already having to pay. That kind of thinking isn't really sound and has been shown to not be sound. But I want some experts, Tommy, to tell me that this is right. I want economists. I want to even hear from accountants that they've run these numbers and they work. And so far we haven't.
And the other thing is that as you go forward, you mentioned earlier we began a conversation with people leaving the state because of maybe schools or health care. And if something like this would affect that, then instead of leading more people into the state, it would lead more people away. And that's another consideration. Thank you, Representative. We'll take a break. We come back. We're going to talk to Bryson Graham, General Manager of the Pelicans. A great story. This guy started as an intern and is now the General Manager of the Pelicans. A great American success story. And we're thrilled to have the Pelicans here. Time now, WWL First News. 8:45, quarter till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL, happy, excited to be the official station of your New Orleans Pelicans. And just when you get to feeling good about yourself, you know, you've reached a place in life where it's like, all right, yeah, I'm doing pretty well. Yeah, I'm not, you know, that young anymore, but I'm doing pretty good. You find a story like Bryson Graham, who is the general manager of one of only 30 NBA teams at 37 years old. How you doing, Bryson?
I'm doing all right. How about yourself?
I'm all right. Congratulations. That's huge, man. I know we're going to talk about the Pelicans and your moves and everything, but I want to talk about your story because I think it's fascinating. You started as an intern at the Pelicans? Oh, at the Hornets, actually, right?
All the way dating back to the Hornets days. So I played basketball at Texas A&M University. Mm-hmm. I finished up and I did a graduate assistant year in 2009, 2010. And not really knowing what I want. Well, I knew what I wanted to do next. I had two ACL injuries, and I knew my basketball career is definitely going to get cut short. So I began reaching out to any and everybody in the NBA that I could get an email. And I was willing to do literally anything just to get my foot in the door. So I was like, look, I will run through any wall, scrub any toilet, do anything necessary to get a job. And just so happened that Dale Demps, who was the previous general manager, was coming in one day to watch us practice. Mm-hmm. And I met him at right place, right time. I just believe all in God's hands. And I got an internship, and from then on I've been with the company ever since, and just kind of, you know, worked and been diligent, and just very fortunate that Mrs. B and David Griffin have just blessed me with this opportunity.
I think it's a great story, and mine, while not, you know, a general manager of the Pelicans, is a lot like yours, starting and doing kind of every job in between. So you kind of know what everybody's job is, don't you?
Yes, sir. I have been legitimately is the lowest man on the totem pole, and that's okay. And that's okay for anyone to start there. It builds character. One, two, it teaches you all the foundational principles about your organization. And so I really do feel like I have been raised and raised the right way within the business world of basketball and sports through the organization of the Pelicans. And so, it's kind of like me being homegrown. Although I'm not from New Orleans, mm-hmm. I've been here now going into my 15th season. I feel like I am, you know, like I feel like I'm a product of this organization, and I'm excited about the opportunity.
I think if we can get you to stop pronouncing your R's, you'll be okay. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Have a beer in the car, that kind of thing. You know, drive your car, park your car, that kind of thing. Look, so let me ask you this. Yeah. I always like to get the personal part of this, Bryson. You get named general manager, and you got the keys to the car in your hand, right? I mean, it's like, here we go. Here are the keys of the franchise. What's going through your mind at that point? I got to believe it's a little bit of thank goodness and oh my God, right?
Definitely. But you know, I'm under, you know, obviously great leadership in David Griffin, and I mean, he's been obviously such a pivotal piece in all of this. And I've really learned a lot, you know, with him over the last five seasons. But there was still that nervousness, right? Because you've never done the job before, and no one has ever, you know. Before they get a job, you know, whether in any organization, you know, if it's your first time, it's your first time. So all the experiences that you've acquired and obtained along the way, you still never sat in the seat. And so I'm still learning as each and every day, and I'm definitely don't have any ego. Everybody in our building, I just see it as a title. I don't see it as I'm your boss. You do what I say, or anything like that. I really want to know where the shortcomings are and where we can get better. And I'm always an open book, and I pride myself on that style of leadership.
In the little bit I've spoken to you, I will bet, and I'm looking at a story here about something with snack bars or something, I'll bet you are you would still do whatever you saw that needed to be done, be it snack bars. You're the guy that picks up the paper off the floor if you see it. Am I wrong?
Yes. Yes. No question. And I don't think that's ever gonna go anywhere. Maybe my day is a little bit more busy, and sometimes I may not be able to get back to you as fast as I once did. But if a job needs to get done, I don't care how small the job is. It just needs to get done. And like I said, the ego part of me just does not exist. And whatever needs to get done, I'm willing to do it. And sometimes you need some of that humble pie. There's some sweat on the ground. Go wipe it up. There's some trash on the floor. Mm-hmm. Go go pick it up. If there's a free agent that's coming into town and you need to go ride, go pick him up from the airport. Don't be too big to say, hey, I'm not doing that. You know, it's what makes our organization special, because I think from top to bottom, I think that lives in our building.
What's the old saying? The guy that holds the broom is closest to the handle. I'm messing that up, but you know what I'm talking about, right?
I know not.
Somebody
not
will text it
fully,
in.
But I've heard that.
Somebody will text it in because I'm messing that up.
Sure.
I can't imagine being 37 years old, going back to when I was, and being a general manager of the Pelicans. Let's talk about DeJounte Murray, how excited you are about that, and how, where did that idea come from? How did all that come to be?
Yeah, well, we've starting the off season, we wanted to get better, and we really wanted to address our playmaking and our ability to pressure the paint. Zion does a lot of that for us, but we ride Z pretty heavily, and so DeJounte, given his track record, and obviously he's second team all defense at a really early age. He's been an All Star. He's had a ton of success on the defensive end, but also offensively, he fits what we were looking for. And so we targeted him pretty early in the process, and we just stayed with it and executed a deal that we thought was good for, honestly, we thought was good for both teams.
We're excited. Speaking of deals that are good for both teams, we're excited about having the Pelicans, a partnership with WWL, a new TV network, Gray Media television station, including Fox 8 in New Orleans. First preseason game gets underway Monday. We'll have it on 870 AM WWL. Talk about the Pelican side of that. I know you're excited to be with us, I believe, right, Bryson?
Yes. No question. I mean, I think it's great. It's great for the city. It's great for the culture. And it just, you know, it's just putting out that outreach that everyone's going to be able to really tap in, watch games, listen to games, and get our fan base behind us this year. It's so important to have the support of your city and surrounding areas, right? So we're really, really excited about it.
And the Gulf South. I mean, it's got to be a regional approach, I believe, right?
No question. You got to bring in your entire region. I think we've got a ton of basketball fans. Obviously, we know we have the football fans, but I think we've got basketball fans as well. This is just such a great opportunity. I thought, you know, our organization did a phenomenal job of putting this together, and I'm really, really excited. We're all excited.
I appreciate the time, Bryson. Congratulations. We look forward to the Pelicans. We're looking forward to the season. I hope we get to talk to you again, all right? I think you got a great story.
Thank you. Thank
I think
you.
You'll
Anytime.
Do well.
Thank
all
you.
Right. Bryson Graham, general manager of the Pelicans, started as an intern. Thank you, Dave. We always try to do something a little bit different, and we're joined now by David McCloskey, a former CIA analyst, author of The Seventh Floor, his third novel, and he has been there and done that. And I want to invite the audience in here at 504-260-1870, the Oakland Heart Jeweler Talk and Text line, as we begin the conversation. If you have any questions or comments about the CIA or tradecraft or what's real or what's not, text him in, and I'll pass him along. With that, we welcome in David McCloskey. How are you, sir?
Hey, I'm doing well, Tommy. Thanks for having me on.
I read a ton of stuff for work, and it your book was the first novel I read in a long time, and I had to suspend my disbelief in a second because I was starting to fact-check everything, and I'm thinking, wait a minute, there's a novel now. Hang on a second. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. I got to tell you that. It really was very enjoyable, and I'm looking forward to now reading the first two. Tell me about, how does a CIA analyst become a novelist?
Well, it was certainly a bit of a roundabout path. You know, I was in for a little under 10 years and never had the thought that I would leave and start writing. But most of my time while I was at CIA, I was working on the Middle East and in particular on Syria. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that was the topic for my first book, Damascus Station. And, you know, that period working on Syria really was an emotional one for me in many respects. You know, I had lived there, worked on it, and you just watched this whole country, you know, fall apart in the middle of the Civil War. And so for me, as I left the agency, writing was a way to sort of come to terms with that and to process it. And, you know, I did that for a while before I ever thought about publishing anything. It was just kind of a way to sort of understand what I thought about the world. And at some point, I sort of straightened myself out and said, how do I write something that not only I want to write, but that other people want to read? And the books have come out of that process.
What I read, and I presume what you've written in all three of your books, is real, but it's set in it's real tradecraft, it's real processes, etc., but it's set in a fictional setting. Accurate?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, I think the books have now dealt with very, very different kind of geopolitical settings, right? The first one was Syria, the second one was Russia. This most recent one, The Seventh Floor, is kind of present day Langley, and kind of the CIA with a bit of Russia thrown in. So there's different settings, but I think consistently throughout them, I'm really trying to get the CIA right. You know, there's a lot of really wonderfully entertaining spy fiction out there that doesn't even really try to deal realistically with the tradecraft, much less with, you know, kind of the culture, the bureaucracy, the moral ethic of the place, right? I find that stuff endlessly fascinating and really try in every book, as much as I can responsibly, of course, to really bring the readers into that world, to show them how the CIA actually operates. What are the people like that work there? What does an actual intelligence operation look like, soup to nuts? How do they work? You know, I want to bring readers into that inner ring and show them kind of a bit of the secret world that we don't normally see.
Without giving away any secrets, and along those lines, does the CIA have to vet any of your work?
They do. Yeah, they do. I am required to send anything I write about, you know, CIA, tradecraft, anything I worked on while I was inside the agency, I have to send to them, to a group called the Publication Review Board. And they read everything. They determine if there's anything sensitive in there, and then redact it out if it is, you know. And it's very almost amusing sometimes to deal with them, because they send everything back. For some reason, you know, I send them a Word document. When it comes back to me, it's all capitalized. It's in, you know, dozens of PDF files. And best of all, it's literally redacted with a black highlighter. So it kind of looks like it's come out of, you know, a time machine from 1965. But they have so far been flexible in working with me, and I've never had to really change a story or change a plot because of any redactions from CIA.
And what I love about the novel I read, and I want to read the first two, is that it really does expose, and I always did have this feeling, and I've always been fascinated by this kind of work and the tradecraft involved, the Hall of Mirrors that you people live in, right? Because I don't know how you determine what's real and what's not. And one thing that stood out to me in the book was detail and attention to detail, and how I guess that helps you with a story if you focus on details of any one thing.
Yeah, you know, it's
if that makes sense, if I'm presenting it properly.
No, yeah, it feels. Look, I think they're novels, right? They're spy fiction. So the paramount, the goal, the objective, right, is for the reader to come into this world and to consume the story, ideally, you know, sacrificing sleep and family time to do so, because they're just so pulled into the world. Mm-hmm. And to do that, you have to set a groundwork or sort of a foundation of, in my opinion, authenticity or realism, obviously to the characters, to the geopolitics, but because it's a spy novel, to the tradecraft and the detail of how CIA actually functions and what operations actually, like how they actually are conducted, right? And if I don't get those little details right, you, the reader, at some point, even if you're not part of this world, you're going to sort of sniff it out, and you're going to know that it's not grounded in reality. And at some point, you might say, well, I'll try another world. I'll go read something else. So I think getting those details right down to, like, the level of, okay, how do CIA officers, when they're trying to move around to spot surveillance, how do you do that? What is like? What are the processes for that? What are the techniques? What does it feel like to do that? I'm trying to bring to life kind of the biology of it, the smells of it, the taste of it, the sensation. So you, the reader, are sort of drawn into that world as well.
And I think you do a great job, and I'm specifically, I don't think I'm giving anything away here, I'm talking about this part, the section where Sam is in at the Gator Farm and he's trying to memorize every detail. And I guess I'm thinking about the tradecraft that's involved there. How do agents keep their stories straight? And when I mention Hall of Mirrors, how do you know what's real and what's not? Because in this novel especially, you talk about, you know, there's a mole and there have been agents and counter-agents. How do you know that who you're running is not running you? I don't know how you know who to trust.
Yeah. Well, you know, that is some of the fun of these types of books is that you don't, you know, and really the premise of The Seventh Floor is essentially there is a Russian mole or double agent operating in the upper reaches of Langley on the seventh floor, which is kind of the executive suite where the director works, you know, who is it? Right. And the main character, Artemis Proctor and Sam, who you mentioned, are investigating this kind of short list of suspects. So it's a bit of a whodunit. But of course, to your point, Tommy, like we don't know. We don't know who to trust.
But all I mean, in the field, I guess what I'm getting at, David, is in the field, how do you know? I don't want you to give away any secrets or anything, obviously, but how do you separate what's real from what's not? How do you keep that straight in your mind?
Yeah. Well, it's hard. I mean, you know, and when you're dealing with humans who you've potentially recruited to supply you with secrets, you know, it's sort of stock and trade in the business to say that most of these people have a bit of a screw loose. Mm-hmm. And so there's a constant effort to test and vet, to understand if this person that you've recruited is actually the real deal, giving the people polygraphs, checking their information against other sources, giving them tests that they might not even understand or tests, but that allow you to monitor them to understand if they're doing what they said they would do. All of these things sort of are put together, you know, to understand if the agent or the asset that we've recruited is actually under our control or influence or producing things that are true and real. And many times, you know, the picture can be very complicated, where in some cases assets provide things that are, you know, legitimate intelligence, and then they turn around a few months later and they're sort of, you know, making things up because they want more money or, you know, they want, you know, your approval. It's a very tricky business where you're constantly dealing with the gray, not black and white.
Can anybody really keep a secret?
Yes. You know, people can, not everybody, and certainly not all the time, but, you know, most of the agency officers that I work with are, you know, exceptional at compartmentalizing and keeping secrets, or sort of knowing what are the secrets to keep, right? And what can be shared. But yes, they're out there. They're a rare breed, but they're out there.
When it comes to intelligence gathering, let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. We're talking to David McCloskey, former CIA analyst. His newest book is The Seventh Floor. It's a fun read. We're going to talk about gathering intel and the ways officers do that, open source intelligence, human intelligence. We spoke at one point to James Olson, a former chief of counterintelligence, and he mentioned at one point he and his family had to leave because they were compromised. And I don't know how you can have a real life and a CIA life as well, but you all managed to do it. If y'all have any questions or comments, 504-260-1870. I'll pass them along when we come back on WWL. We're talking to David McCloskey, former CIA analyst, author of The Seventh Floor. That's his newest book. His first two are, I have in front of me here, Damascus Station and Moscow X. He is a former CIA analyst, former consultant at McKinsey & Company, and we love picking his brain. The book is very enjoyable, and David, it was so fun to read something that's not a policy paper or a news story or something else. I got to tell you, how do people get the books?
You can get them pretty much anywhere books are sold. You can get them at Barnes & Noble. You can get it at Amazon. You can get it at IndieBound. and it's in audio book, ebook, hardcover. So pretty much any format, any place you get your books, you can find it there.
And the name of this one is The Seventh Floor. Somebody texted in and said, in your opinion, David, what film or TV series comes closest to the reality of CIA agents and actions?
Mm-hmm. Well, that is a tough question because there isn't any one that I think does it exceptionally well. One I will say that gets it pretty close is actually a French series called Le Bureau, mm-hmm. which does a great job with the sort of office politics of an intelligence agency, the bureaucracy, the relationship between headquarters and the field, which is always a point of tension. So Le Bureau does a great job. Some American listeners will probably remember the show The Americans mm-hmm. from about a decade ago about Russian illegals operating in the States. I thought that show did a great job with the street tradecraft, disguises, things like that, that actually are a part of the intelligence business. Another one that I think does a great job with sort of the psychology of working under deep cover is the Netflix show called The Spy, mm-hmm. which is about an Israeli officer under non-official cover in Syria back in the 60s. That show does a fantastic job showing just how difficult it is for somebody to sort of stay undercover for a very long period of time in a very hostile place. Those would be three that I would offer up as good examples of, you know, sort of the mentality and the tradecraft and the operations of the spy business.
So how do you manage to have a real life and an agency life? Because, you know, I guess the people that are killed in action with the CIA have just a star in the wall, right? We never do find out their names, accurate?
Some of them over time have become sort of public.
I guess what I'm saying is there are a lot of heroes that make a big difference in the security of this nation that we never know about. That's accurate?
Yeah, That's absolutely true.
So along those lines, tell me about the sacrifices of the people, and how can you have a real life in addition to an agency life? I don't know how you could do that.
Well, I think it really is hard. And in particular, if you are a case officer who is out there in the field actually trying to recruit spies and run spies, that is it's exceptionally challenging to actually have a normal existence and do that at the same time. And frankly, it's the reason why, it's a very hard job. It's very hard on families. The divorce rate in particular for case officers is sky high. It's exceptionally hard. And, you know, it's sort of doubly hard in many respects because there really isn't public acknowledgement for what you're doing. You know, it really is a shadow business. And so the people who are doing that every day, these kind of secret servants, they do a tremendous amount for the safety and security of our country and really don't get many plaudits for it at all. But it's very hard. It's very challenging to maintain, I think, a kind of normal existence when, you know, everything you're showing to the outside world is actually sort of a deception, right, to hide the reality that you're working for CIA.
It's not an overstatement to say that the work of the CIA has prevented wars and attacks, right?
No, absolutely not an overstatement. That's absolutely true.
Tell me about how does one become a CIA agent? I know you mentioned the farm, right? That's where they train CIA agents?
The farm is where they would do the training for case officers, absolutely. You get into CIA through a number of different routes, some of which are very normal. You know, I mean, I was recruited out of my college as a 19 and 20-year-old to actually join the CIA as an intern, if you can believe it. I took my first polygraph when I was 19. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people come in through school. It's kind of a typical route. Others would come in, you know, later in life after they have some work experience, or in particular, if they have a technical skill, you know, particularly with, you know, coding, let's say, or if they've, you know, written their PhD thesis on, you know, Vladimir Putin, right? I mean, these are the kind of specialists that we're looking for. So there's no really one route in, but it is very sort of dependent on the type of job that they're recruiting you for. I mean, the CIA is a very big place. There's all kinds of people there, from the folks who are actually out there recruiting spies all the way into people who are doing a lot of the tech stuff. So it's a big place that's recruiting all over, and oftentimes quite openly, to try to find the talent that we need to run, you know, a spy agency in the 21st century.
If you had to pick a quality that a case officer had, I guess I'm using a phrase right, somebody out in the field, that's right, case officer?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Quality, would it be nerves of steel? Would it be an excellent memory? What would you say? Or maybe a couple of them, qualities.
I think you've hit two spot on. You need to be able to approach risk with courage and boldness, and you need to be able to, I mean, you know, you'll see in the novels, I try to render this effectively, the ability to catalog a massive amount of information in your mind and hold it there, you know, really matters a lot. The other thing I would add to that list is there is a trade-off or sort of a balance between needing people who are, you know, kind of adrenaline junkies to a degree. I mean, that helps, but you also need to be able to balance that with the ability to appropriately assess risk. And so you need people who are not going to, you know, skydive without the parachute, let's say, right? And you kind of also need people who are good with people, who get how people work and are able to assess them quickly to understand how you might, or if it's even possible, to move someone to sharing a secret with us that they shouldn't. Those are all very unique skills, and I think they tend to be what the agency looks for when you're thinking about the people who you want, you know, recruiting spies.
A lot of tensions in the Middle East right now. How much of the Israeli response, how much is the United States response, prevention, preparation based on intelligence that's being gained on the ground?
Well, I mean, I think on the Israeli side of things, you know, just if we took the pager attack, we took the, you know, decapitation of Hezbollah's leadership over the past month, that has all been enabled by intelligence gathering probably over years in Syria, in Iran, in Lebanon, to map that network to understand who's who, who reports to who lives where, how do they get there, where do they have meetings. I mean, very specific details would have been required for Mossad and the IDF to be able to conduct these attacks so precisely. That is all enabled by an intelligence picture. It's all enabled by massive investments in time and resources that probably go back well over a decade. So, and that's all unseen. You know, we just see the strikes. We just see the pagers blowing up, but we don't really see all the legwork that went into it. And I think it's the same. I mean, you know, it's really the same on the air defense picture, let's say, to take down, you know, these drones and missiles that are arriving in Israel. I mean, a massive investment of technology, of intelligence resources over a long period of time to be able to create that kind of defense and deterrence. I mean, and this is, you know, it's wild because the public just, you don't see this stuff until something pops above the surface or something blows up. But there's a tremendous amount of detailed legwork that goes into each and every one of these operations, and that sort of undergirds, right, this whole sort of shadow war that has burst into the open in the Middle East over the past year.
I enjoyed your book thoroughly. I could talk to you for 25 hours about this straight. David McCloskey, former CIA analyst, author of The Seventh Floor. You can find it at any bookstore. And, man, I'm going to tell you, it was a very enjoyable read. Thank you for writing it. I'll check out the first two, Damascus Station and Moscow X. A pleasure to talk to you. Thank you, David.
Likewise, Tommy. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. David McCloskey, former CIA analyst, and the book is called The Seventh Floor. We'll take a break, talk to Jeff Nowak when we come back. WWL Saints sideline reporter, 9:36, 24 till 10. Traffic now, WWL. Hi, 9:42, 18 till 10. Jeff Nowak joins us now, WWL Saints sideline reporter. How you doing, Jeff?
Doing good, Tommy. How are you?
Man, that blue injury tent had more people going in at Sunday than Walmart.
Yeah, that's not fun. That's the NFL for you.
Yeah, what are you going to do? Let's talk about, before we get to the injury situation, all of that, the news all over the place, of course, is Davante Adams. I don't know. Tell me the story. For people that don't know, I know the story, but for people that don't, explain who he is and what the connection is and where we stand with all of this.
Yeah, so Davante Adams, receiver for the Raiders, obviously spent forever with Aaron Rodgers in Green Bay. He's dealing with a hamstring injury right now. Whatever that has to do with anything is kind of neither here nor there, but he told the Raiders he would like to be traded. So that's where they are. And the Saints happen to be in a position where they're, you know, he went to Fresno State with Derek Carr, so they have a connection there. Obviously, when he was traded to the Raiders, part of that reason was Derek Carr was there, so they have a very strong connection. The Saints also have Keith Williams as their wide receivers coach, who, when you know it, recruited Davante Adams to Fresno State, has been like a father figure to him. They've worked together in the off seasons. So you, when a guy has to be traded and you have all that going for you, the Saints obviously become a destination where, like, okay, can they pull off a trade? Now, the issue is Davante Adams, a 31-year-old wide receiver. He's on a massive contract. The Saints obviously, you know, kind of notoriously never have any cap space to work with beyond, hey, we're going to make this work with restructures and we're going to do this and that. They can get it done. So the question becomes, hey, is it something that you should do? Is it something that you want to do? And anytime a star receiver comes available, you have to kick the tires on it. You know, they'd probably have to give up a premium draft asset, either a second or a third round pick, probably a player on top of that, and then leverage their salary cap in a season that they went into with some pretty moderate, you know, idea that they were going to try to reset and work back to the middle, as Mickey Loomis would say. You've made some pretty conservative signings. You didn't go out this offseason and sign people to these crazy deals. You signed mostly one-year contracts, a lot of stuff that's not committed down the road. So it would be a pretty strong departure from that idea if you suddenly said, hey, at 2-2, we're ready to go all in again. So that's kind of where we are. I feel like, and I think the common idea is, hey, he's going to end up back with Aaron Rodgers, he's going to get traded to the Jets, a team that has plenty of cap space to work with. They have draft assets that they could send and probably do feel like, not unlike where the Saints were with Drew Brees at the end of his career, that, okay, we have a title window with this quarterback. We want to give him every opportunity to succeed. So I think that's where you are. If I'm the Saints and I make this deal, I want to do it on my terms. I'm not getting into a bidding war. Mm-hmm. So I would wait it out, and maybe if there's no deal develops, his market goes down and you can get him in more at a price point that makes sense. The Raiders pick up some of that salary. You could get it done. But otherwise, I think it's kind of a lot of noise that won't amount to anything from the Saints' end. I'd be very, very surprised if they made a trade. But that's kind of where you are.
You know, you talk about his hamstring. It does really matter if he can play or not, right? I mean, do you know if he's healthy?
Yeah, I don't think it's anything that you're worried about long term. It's just kind of a maintenance thing. I mean, we saw Chris Olave deal with a hamstring injury this week and play through it. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that it's something that you would be like, well, he's not going to be healthy enough to play, because if you made that trade, you're not making a trade for a guy midweek and then saying, yeah, he's going to be ready to play on Sunday. He's going to know our system. He's going to know everything. So there would be a ramp up process anyway, and it would probably take 1 to 2 weeks before you felt like he was ready to really contribute in any meaningful way. So I don't think that's going to be the issue if there was a trade on the table that the Saints wanted to make.
And since we're talking about it, what kind of a difference do you think he could make?
I mean, he would become a kind of a security blanket for Derek Carr, a guy, you know, like the Saints. I mean, the Raiders offense in 2022 didn't exactly blow anyone away. Derek ended up getting benched for the final two games of that season. So it wasn't exactly a match made in heaven, but they still combined for 1,290 yards and 12 touchdowns. Davante Adams had an all-pro season with Derek Carr, so they clearly feel comfortable together. I kind of look at, you know, if you go back and watch that fourth down play where Derek kind of threw up the ball to Rashid in the end zone, he wasn't able to come down with it. I think that's what you would be gaining more so than anything else. He's a guy that could operate out of the slot, but he's also a guy that I feel like will be able to go up and make contested catches, right, to be able to battle for a ball. He's a big physical receiver. And that's what I don't think the Saints necessarily have right now. They have two really good receivers in Chris Olave and Rashid Shaheed. They guys that can get open, they can beat you downfield, they can win in a lot of different ways. But in those instances where it's like, hey, I have man-to-man, one-on-one coverage on the outside, they're going to send a zero blitz at me. I have to throw the ball early and trust my receiver to go get it. I don't know if you have that. And I kind of go back to week one in 2022, Dennis Allen's first game. What did you do to score that final touchdown? Jameis threw the ball up to Mike Thomas in one-on-one coverage, and he just mossed the guy. He went up over him, and he caught it. Mm-hmm. That's the element that I don't think the Saints offense has right now. So if I'm adding Devontae, it's that. It's that kind of contested catchability that I'm not just getting. I'm getting in a premium way with a receiver that has kind of been on autopilot for 1,000 yards. He has four consecutive 1,000-yard seasons. It would be six if he had three more yards. I think he had 997 yards 1 year. And if that was 1,000 yards, you would be, if you round up, that's six consecutive 1,000-yard seasons. So you're just getting a proven commodity. And I don't think any NFL team would get better by adding him. It's just a question of at what cost.
Let's talk about the Saints injury situation heading into Kansas City. Do we know what we know, or do we not know what we don't know?
Well, so, you know, this is normally by Thursday morning, we would have a picture of the Saints injury status. This week, since they're playing on Monday, the initial injury report doesn't come out until this afternoon. Dennis Allen wouldn't give us any hints or clues or really any information at all into the injury status for certain guys. I think that's something that he's decided is going to be a way he gains an advantage this year, is keeping the other team guessing as late in the week as possible. And I can't begrudge a head coach that. You know, find a way to whatever you think helps, go for it. But there's certainly a lot of questions. You know, how did Chris Olave come out of that game? How is that hamstring feeling? A lot of times you'll be able to play through something in the moment and then it kind of creeps up on you. So you have to watch that. Same thing with Alvin Kamara. He was dealing with a rib issue. How did he come out of that game? Taysom Hill obviously left that game with a rib issue. Already had a lung injury, a chest injury, whatever you want to call it, earlier in the season. So how did he come out of that game? A.T. Perry missed that game with a hamstring injury. That's an issue. Willie Gay left with a hand injury. That's an issue. So there's a lot of players that we're going to have to watch and see their status going into next week. Cesar Ruiz is another big one. He missed the game with a knee injury. DeMario Davis is a big one. He missed a game with a hamstring injury. Tyrann Mathieu left with a groin injury. He was already nursing a heel injury, and he kind of said that the groin injury is a product of, hey, you're kind of accommodating one injury and you put more on other parts of your body to, you know, compensate, and then you get injured elsewhere. So yeah, there's a lot of questions. The big mystery that we don't know for sure yet, we'll get an answer to this afternoon when they get out there to practice. Kendre Miller has been on IR for the first month of the season. He's eligible to return to practice this week. Once you bring a player back, you kind of start the clock on the 21-day window to either add them back to your active roster, or if you do not add them within that window, then they would be done for the season. So I would expect him to be out there. DA was coy about it. But, you know, you look at a guy who's missed 2.5 months essentially with a hamstring injury. You have to imagine if he's not ready by now, he's not going to be ready. So we'll see how that goes. If he can get out there, I think it would be a long shot to expect him to be ready to play on Monday. But, you know, the earlier you can get him back out to practice, the earlier you can expect him to be a contributor. Because I think the Saints, one thing they really do need is another punch at the running back position. To this point, it's basically been Alvin Kamara and Taysom Hill and nothing else. And both those guys are now dealing with rib injuries. And I think that's a product of, hey, you're giving them a heavy workload. They're getting taken hit after hit after hit. If you want those guys available to you later in the season, you're going to have to find a way to take some of that workload off them now. And I think Kendre Miller is the guy you look at as saying, hey, maybe he can be that guy.
I can only imagine the night Alvin Kamara had after playing with, was it a broken rib?
Hey, there's been some reports that it's a broken rib, cracked rib. I don't know, whatever you want to call it. It's definitely a significant rib injury that he's playing through. And, you know, you'll get the good stuff to kind of numb it up and play through it. But yeah, and I think that's just a situation where, hey, you may have taken some hits throughout the game that you weren't even aware of in the moment, and then the next day you wake up and you're like, well, that hurts. So yeah, it's always going to be a question of, A, can you continue to play through an injury, and how much can you do throughout the week? And we'll start to get a picture of that today.
And when you say that hurts, you're talking about breathing being that. Let's talk about Shane Lemieux and Lucas Patrick.
Yeah, so you had Shane starting at center. You know, he had his struggle points, obviously. It's his first ever time starting at that position. You know, he had always been told, he said, like, throughout his career, hey, we think you can play center. Well, he never actually did. Now, he didn't do it at Oregon. He didn't do it with the Giants, I think, in large part because he was hurt a lot of his time with the Giants. But I thought he held up pretty well. And now the question becomes, if you get Cesar Ruiz back and you have Landon Young as that backup option, are you better off throwing him at left guard and putting Lucas at center? I'm not sure. And that's going to be something that we kind of figure out throughout this week, is whether that's the best course of action. But I think you got some positive answers in terms of, okay, we can get this done with Lucas at center. With Shane at center. And I think Lucas is probably a better left guard than a center. So are you better off keeping him at left guard? I don't know. But one way or the other, there was a scenario where that game kind of really came apart because the offensive line couldn't block. And they did allow a decent amount of pressure. I think Derek handled that pretty well. I think the worst drive, you would say, was the final one before halftime. Kind of got bogged down in midfield. Derek had to throw multiple balls away because he was just, you know, got three guys chasing after him. But generally speaking, I think you saw some positive things with that group, to the point that, okay, you can move forward without Eric McCoy. You're definitely not going to have him for at least another three games, probably a little bit longer as he comes back from that groin surgery that he had. It's going to, hopefully that group can continue to take steps forward throughout the course of the season.
Need a quick yes or no. You tweeted about the Saints. This would be a Super Bowl or bust thing if they did get Davante Adams. Would he be the difference between the Saints going to Super Bowl or not? Yes or no?
That's hard to say. I'd say no. I don't think you're one player away, but it doesn't matter what I think. It matters what the front office thinks.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time. Back in a flash, we'll find out what Newell Norman's got planned for us today on WWL.